Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, darn, or words to that effect. Many economists had hoped that for the first time in 2 years, the U.S. would gain jobs in December. But today, the Labor Department reported that employers cut 85,000 jobs last month, and the unemployment rate is still 10%. An economist at Credit Suisse had another word to sum it up, disappointment, because more people are giving up looking for work. But there are some bright spots. Nigel Gault is chief U.S. economist for IHS Global Insight in Lexington, Massachusetts. Nigel, what do these numbers mean to you?
Well, I think what it meant was that we got a little excited over the November report last month, which was much better than expected. And we actually know now that we added a few jobs in November, only 4,000, but just a few. But unfortunately, that was a little bit too good to be true. We've suffered a payback in December. We've lost those 85,000 jobs. This doesn't alter the fact that the trend is clearly getting better. The trend of job decreases is getting closer to zero. By the time we get through the first quarter, I think we'll be seeing the numbers actually running positive.
A couple other things that jumped out at us. Temporary job hiring is up for the third month in a row. And earlier this week, it was reported that manufacturing activity is up. So your thoughts on those two stats?
Yes, I think the two are actually linked because I think that some of these temporary workers, they're actually being put to work in the manufacturing sector and helping to boost manufacturing output, which is coming back quite sharply now because firms have cut their inventories so low that they actually need to start to rebuild them now, and they're improving production. I'd also note the last time we got a similar surge in temporary employment for 3 months in a row was back in the middle of 2003. And it was just 2 months after that surge that total payrolls turned positive for good. So that's one potential hopeful sign for the near future.
But what about this other discouraging news that people are just dropping out of the labor force, taking themselves out, giving up?
Yes, a lot of people gave up in December. That suggests that they are not yet perceiving an improvement in the labor market. Now, what is likely to happen as we go through 2010, if we do start to add jobs as we expect, some of those people are going to come back into the labor force, are going to start looking again, and that's actually going to mean that it's going to be quite difficult to get the unemployment rate down, because even if we're adding jobs, we're going to start to see the labor force picking up, right? Unemployment's likely to stay stuck at around 10%.
Right. You're adding not only jobs, but you're adding people looking for jobs if they come back in.
Right.
And we understand now that if you do count people who are discouraged or part-timers who, you know, may register as employed but actually want even better jobs, that so-called underemployment rate in December rose to 17.3%.
That's right. So I think that's just an indication of the magnitude of the problem we've got in the labor market and of how long it's going to take to get things to back to anything like normal.
And how long do you think that is?
I think it's going to, frankly, take up to a decade to get us back to an unemployment rate that we would consider to be acceptable, 5%, 6%.
A decade?
Yep.
Well, and when the jobs do start coming back over those 10 years, will it be because of things that have already been done? Or do you think that other things will have to happen in order for even that recovery to happen?
I think that recovery is on the way in part because of things that have been done, all the stimulus that's been put in by the Federal Reserve and by the government. But in the longer term, we're going to be dependent on the private sector to create these jobs. We can't rely on stimulus much longer. The federal government is actually going to have to start cutting its deficit, which means cuts in spending and is going to mean higher taxes. So that fiscal adjustment is going to be a major drag on the expansion over the next 10 years.
Well, and you say 10 years to get to 6% unemployment, but how soon to get to just job gain?
Oh, to get to job gains, I think we're going to see jobs starting to increase in the first quarter, January, February, and March, and particularly strongly in the second quarter, April, May, and June, because there's going to be a big boost coming from the census, which will be hiring lots of people into temporary jobs in the federal government. But we think we'll be adding, over the course of the year, maybe around 800,000 jobs total.
Well, some good news there. Nigel Gault, Chief U.S. Economist for IHS Global Insight in Lexington, Massachusetts, on today's report from the Labor Department. Nigel, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you.
We just read a beautiful book, American Buffalo in Search of a Lost Icon. Some of the best writing on our great national beast since George Catlin, and that was in 1841, says Bill McGibbon. A lesson for the head, heart, and stomach, says the San Francisco Chronicle. And we would add, we were touched by author Stephen Ranella's encyclopedic knowledge of and respect for the buffalo, from the overhunting that drove the huge animal to near extinction, to today's debate over controlling the herd in Yellowstone, to efforts to buy up land for buffalo to roam on. It's a buffalo love story, which made it even more perplexing to us that ultimately, in the end, Stephen hunts and slaughters one.
My quest to understand the buffalo has carried me across several years and thousands of miles. Yet only rarely have I been able to see the animal in the way that I see this calf, as an untethered beast living outside human context and beyond the reach of human history. But my enjoyment of this animal as a simple biological being is short-lived. Within seconds, my concentration is broken by a question that I've been struggling with for the past few months. How can I claim to love the very thing that I work so hard to kill?
And author Stephen Ranella joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me on. I've always enjoyed the conversations on your show.
Thank you. And as you know, you're talking to a vegetarian, so you know that questions arise when people read this book. But as we just heard, you have them yourself. How do you answer that question when you find yourself wondering, how can I love them so much and admire them so much and kill them?
I really can't divorce the issue of, like, how did I kill a buffalo with how have I ever killed anything, because I've been hunting my entire life. And I used to spend a lot of intellectual energy explaining it to people. The older I get, the more it kind of feels like it almost starts to seem like I'm explaining, like, why I might be attracted to my wife. It's just like something so elemental to me. But I have a few things that individually might sound like justifications, but when you pool them all together, it creates a somewhat compelling picture. With the case of the buffalo, human hunters or humans have been in North America for maybe around 14,000 years. And one thing that marks that entire time span is that these people, the last couple hundred years notwithstanding, hunted buffalo and worshiped them. So I feel like I'm not going out on a limb to have that feeling. And another thing, in a much more specific case, is that hunters nearly drove them to extinction, but we're almost like sort of making up for our sin or atoning for our sin, because hunters have really delivered them from near extinction now and are responsible for the great rebound that the species has. I mean, there's now 500,000 of them. And most of the really wild ones, you know, that live in Alaska are there because hunters took them there and cultivated those herds.
Well, basically, you say to the question, how can I claim to love the very thing that I worked so hard to kill? The answer is, I just do, and I always will. You just do live with that contradiction.
You really can't get away from the fact that we, and when I say we, I mean specifically that guys like me, pretty much wipe this thing off the face of the earth. It's always in the back of my mind. And I think that a lot of justifications are like these sort of mental calisthenics to try to explain to someone what I just take for granted. And what I take for granted is I have certain caloric needs. I'm going to eat, you know, a certain amount of calories every day. And just so happens that I get the bulk of mine through hunting. If someone just says to me, if they say that I do not think that humans should kill animals under any circumstances whatsoever, then I would never have an argument against them, and I would have absolute respect for that argument, and I almost think they're almost like morally superior to me.
That would be your response to, let's say, someone who really is a devoted vegetarian, but you make another distinction.
I do make another distinction. I think that if someone is going to eat hamburgers in restaurants or eat steak somewhere, you have to come to terms with the fact that someone, usually like a proxy executioner in a slaughter plant, has taken an animal life for you and you have tacitly approved that action. So if you're going to allow that, and if I choose to do that on my own and in a way that I deem sustainable, it's really not something that could be argued against.
In fact, I'm going to be more pointed because you're more pointed in the book. You have a complete disdain for people who eat meat and are critical of hunters.
Not like the kind of disdain where I'd, you know, want to go challenge them to a duel or something, but it annoys me endlessly, and I don't understand where it comes from. And I think it comes from a real separation from what we do and what it really means, and also this ability to kind of tune out the noise of our lives that occurs out of view from us. So you just take for granted that you're going to have food available to you. And you can have a willful ignorance about where it's coming from.
Well, and here's where this conversation may get a little too vivid for some listeners. But you also illustrate for us in reading the book that perhaps a hunt, and we're going to talk about the hunt that you went on, is maybe the most compassionate way to kill an animal if you're going to eat meat. When it's compared to slaughterhouses and the early slaughter of buffaloes that included things like buffalo jumps. You take us through the history of buffalo hunting, and a single shot from the rifle of a caring hunter like yourself does seem more compassionate than, well, describe a buffalo jump.
Basically, it's that you get a large group of animals, a large group of buffalo moving toward a precipice, moving toward a cliff's edge, and you give them the choice of either confronting humans or running the other way, and you get them running in such in a sort of a hysterical mass, and you'll run them off the edge of a cliff, and it injures or kills them. And I'm using the term you here, which I shouldn't be, and this is a practice of Indians, Native Americans. It seems to peak around the time of Christ, so before the introduction of the horse in North America. And it would be a bloody, bawling mass of flesh. And then you'd find that a lot of these animals weren't fully processed. Maybe just their hides were removed. Maybe the only animals on the top of the pile were butchered, which suggests a tremendous amount of waste. When you start digging into the history of human-buffalo interactions, you don't find a lot of gentle compassion.
No, over history, it's not a pretty picture. And you tell us about it. You tell of buffalo forced into snowbanks. They can't walk and they're slaughtered. They're forced out onto ice where they can't stand and are killed. That's in the past. And Stephen, you also say today you have complete disdain for canned hunting. This is when people pay a lot of money to go to ranches. They're driven out, and from the comfort of a Land Rover, they pick off a buffalo that was maybe purchased from a farmer raising them. You say to call this hunting would be like someone playing the video game Grand Theft Audio and then bragging, you know, I'm a car thief. We're talking with Stephen Rinella. His story, like the story of many hunters, is complicated. He stood with protesters at Yellowstone National Park mourning buffalo killed in a hunt there because he says there was no real hunt, just teenagers firing them from a pickup truck at buffalo in front of spectators. But as we've said, Stephen has also killed one himself. His book is American Buffalo in Search of a Lost Icon. So how does he hunt? Well, we'll go with him in 1 minute. Later, Owen Bennett Jones with a provocative thought. Maybe the recidivism rate at that Saudi rehab center for terrorists is one we have to accept. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with veteran hunter Stephen Rinella. In 2005, he won a lottery permit to hunt for one wild buffalo in the Alaskan wilderness. He writes about it and the buffalo's place in the American imagination in his terrific book, American Buffalo, In Search of a Lost Icon. Stephen, on your 10-day hunt, a bush pilot drops you off. You're freezing cold, trying to keep things dry. And irony abounds, you're both predator and prey.
The thing I thought most when I was hunting was kind of loneliness. For me, hunting always has been a thing about food. Food's always at the center of it. But it's also somewhat social, and I usually hunt with my brothers or hunt with friends. And when I went on this trip, because of timing and such, I had to hunt by myself. So my brother and some friends dropped me off in a raft and left me there on the bank of the river. And I headed up into the mountains from there. And then you start to think if something happened to you, no one's ever going to know where you are. You run into wolf tracks, and wolves, they don't cause problems for people. But, like, psychologically, the presence of wolves just starts to make me kind of uneasy. What makes me really uneasy is grizzly bears. And I had a couple grizzly bears who, for several days, were just around all the time, leaving tracks everywhere, following my trail. And it just got to be kind of like a little lonely, a little scared, just kind of general unhappiness, maybe, is what I felt like.
Well, but it also forced you to do all sorts of self-introspection that, again, if someone drove you in a pickup out into a field and you raised a rifle and that was it, you wouldn't do.
I became very fascinated in this process, doing this hunt. I became very fascinated with, you know, what anthropologists often refer to as the first Americans, or the people who crossed the Bering Land Bridge into Alaska and then later down into the lower 48 during the Ice Age. And I'm in no way, like, I'm out there with a rifle, you know, I have a lighter. I'm not equating myself to those people. But to come to terms with just the sort of bewilderment about where you are, not knowing what's around the corner, and this desire to find this animal. And once you find it, you're going to be able to eat as much as you want from it. And I really started to get a contemporary, like as much as it's possible for me to understand and appreciate it, I really tapped into something about like this ancestral desire to hunt. And if I had had a buddy with me, we'd have been talking about Lord knows what. And I might not have had as many opportunities to really ponder some of the bigger issues of hunting that have always swirled around in my mind, but I didn't give them the weight that they deserved until I was out there for 10 days just, you know, ruminating on it. And it gets dark early, so you have even more time to ruminate.
Well, then comes the moment. There he is in your sights.
I had spent the night on a ridgeline above a river called the Chetoslina River. It snowed throughout the night, and I woke up, and it was just getting light. And I crept over to the edge of this ridge so that I was looking down toward the Chetoslina. And there, after a week of looking and seeing animals miles away, I looked and there, 40 yards away, is a herd of buffalo. And I remember this feeling very vividly. I was like, wow, you will now have to kill a buffalo. And I raised up, I had a very high-powered rifle. I raised up and picked a cow or a female that was out in the front of the group and aimed at a few inches behind her shoulder, about halfway up and down the body, and squeezed the trigger. And it went down immediately and slid down a mountainside and crashed into a stand of timber, and it was still and it was dead. And I tell you, you know, like I said, I've done a lot of hunting and, you know, hunted dozens and dozens of animals and, you know, many different species. But that was one of the most stupendous and kind of conflicting moments I've ever had hunting.
You've explained the conflict. You know, you love the animal, but you also know that this is going to be food for a year, but you've just ended a life.
I ended a life, but it's impossible for me to divorce myself from what other hunters have done to this animal, and that just to so ruthlessly and cruelly waste a massive resource. Those animals in Alaska were brought there by a group of hunters. Thanks to that group of hunters, there are now four herds, several hundred animals, and they're sustained by public interest in hunting them. And I'm very aware of the hypocrisy, of the way it must seem hypocritical. Mm-hmm. And I hope someday to nail it better. I'm almost sorry. Like, here I am doing an interview about it, and I still can't quite describe everything that goes through my mind when I think about what I did.
Yeah. Then comes the really hard physical part. I don't think I've ever really understood how difficult field dressing an animal is.
First, I had to get the animal from the mountainside down to the Chetoslina River, which was about a mile from me. Doing that took 3 days, to get it broken down into parts and then to haul those parts and 100-pound backpack loads down to the Chetoslina. And during those 3 days, I didn't have the nerve to sleep on the carcass. Usually, if I was with a friend, I would sleep on a big carcass like that to keep bears away. This way, I was sleeping away from there. And so every morning at daybreak, I'd sneak in there and find out if bears had found it yet. And I'd see tracks, but they never got on the carcass. They never started to eat the meat. So once I got it moved that 1 mile to the Chetoslina, then my friends came down to pick me up. And we moved it 3 miles down the Chetoslina to the mouth of the Copper River. And then we only had to go about 14 more miles downriver to a small town.
Is that all?
So by that point, I had 5 days into moving meat, but I had a year's worth of meat, and I even gave a lot of it away.
Well, of the, I think, 24 hunters who were given permits for that Alaska hunt, only four of you killed a buffalo. And you go back to the place where this happened, and you say you see the replacements of those animals coming towards you. You watch a calf jump in the water, and current brings her downriver, swimming hard. She gets out, shakes dry, and runs to catch up with the herd. You feel a tremendous joy, which turns into words, which you think to yourself, let the buffalo roam.
Yeah, that's my favorite sentence.
And there are going to be people who won't be able to understand that, you know, that you who killed one would think that.
Whether or not they agree with what I did, I hope they agree that we should let the buffalo roam. because then we'll find our common ground in a desire to have more thousands and some days maybe a couple of million running around. And then if one or two go missing every year and they end up in my freezer, you know, no one's going to notice.
Stephen Rinella's book is American Buffalo, In Search of a Lost Icon. Stephen, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me on. It was a real pleasure.
And we're wondering if you have thoughts. We'd love to hear them on this or any story. Just go to hereandnow.org. You can click on Contact Us to send an email, or you can just scroll down and leave a comment right there on the homepage. We'd love to hear from you. Next week on Here and Now, an incredible look at North Korea from six North Koreans who left that country, fled that country. That's next week. Still ahead, world-class athletes in search of money for the Olympics. That's round the corner, Here and Now. President Obama has asked for enhanced airport security techniques, saying the U.S. has to stay one step ahead of a nimble adversary. Well, what about mind readers, lie detectors? They're among the proposals. And already in place, a behavior recognition program at Boston's Logan Airport. It trains everyone, right down to janitors, to observe passenger behavior. Rafi Ron is Logan Airport security consultant and the former director of security at Israel's Ben-Gurion International Airport. He was hired by Massport immediately after the 9/11 attacks. Rafi's also president of New Age Security Solutions. Rafi, welcome back. And why train janitors and vendors?
It is the human factor that we need to introduce back into our security programs, and we need to start focusing more on looking for the bad guys and not just looking for bad items.
How are people trained? What do they look for?
The program is actually based on the idea that a person that is going to carry out a major act of violence is under very unique mental status at a time. This is reflected in the way he or she behaves. The level of stress that they are showing out, and other body language components, but there's much more to it. Because, for example, if you have to walk around with an explosive device on your body, you don't walk the same as other people. You're not dressed the same as other people. Your attitude, that your ability to respond to your environment is different from people who do not experience the same thing that you are feeling at that given moment.
How so? I mean, what do you tell people to look for? Somebody who's sweating, somebody who won't look you in the eye? I mean, what do they look for?
We're trying to avoid being extremely detailed in what we describe in the open media, obviously, in order to prevent the enemy from preparing itself.
Can you tell us this? What do they then do? Let's say somebody's selling a newspaper or a magazine and they think that somebody's acting in a certain way that they've been trained to detect. What do they then do with that information?
We need a full methodology behind the behavior detection to increase the level of information that we have in order to allow us an educated, intelligent decision. And that involves, among other things, also a verbal interaction with the individual that we call targeted conversations, to differ it from traditional law enforcement interviews that are usually rather aggressive. We take a very positive approach based on cooperation.
So we understand you. So someone, you know, working at the airport might notice somebody who seems a little way too anxious. They might, alert a state trooper who then might say to that person, hey, how you
exactly.
doing? How you doing? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That is exactly the idea. Since what we're looking for is irregular behavior, who knows better the regular than the employees of the airport?
Well, we understand something else that's been instituted at the airport. They hold a daily security meeting, representatives from the TSA, the FBI, state police, customs officers, and others. So every day there's a meeting. Well, I want you to tell us, Rafi Ron, what you think about some of the things that are in the pipeline. The Associated Press is reporting about a whole bunch of programs that are being considered. One of them, for instance, is the We See You program. It involves flashing images that might be somehow provocative to terrorists, let's say Al-Qaeda symbols, on screens around the airport, and then having people and or technology watch for reactions to those images. Have you heard about this?
This is a very interesting approach, but I'm afraid at this point in time, this is still very far from being operational.
Well, and there's a lot of concern. I mean, the sensors would, I guess, pick up some sort of suspicious reaction, somebody seeing something that, whoa, what's that doing up there? And then they'd be pulled out. But a lot of people, are likening this to that movie Minority Report, where Tom Cruise played the policeman who arrested people for pre-crimes.
Correct.
But then there's also the thought of putting forms of lie detectors around so that, you know, pupil dilation, facial movements, other signs of deception.
A lot of that at this point is really science fiction, and I'm not sure that we really want to go down this way. I think that some of the civil liberty values that this country is so proud for should be maintained, and we should be very careful in the way we're using this type of total control or Orwellian type technologies. We can still deploy human factor based techniques that use technology but do not rely on technology 100%.
Rely more on the guy selling the donuts. That's Rafi Ron, president of New Age Security Solution, also a security consultant for Boston's Logan International Airport. Rafi, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Okay, up next, the BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones on Saudi Arabia's terrorist rehab program. That's in 30 seconds here and now. There's a firestorm over the release of Guantanamo Bay detainees to a rehab program in Saudi Arabia because some of them have gone on to rejoin al-Qaeda. Republican Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama has demanded the Justice Department stop sending detainees to the program, even though the Saudis claim a success rate of 80% to 90% in reforming jihadists. 1,500 men have gone through the program, including 108 released from Guantanamo Bay. And Justice Department officials say they're facing laws that could prevent them from holding detainees indefinitely in the U.S. But now the government of Yemen also wants its nationals from Guantanamo, and few officials in the U.S. have faith in Yemen's ability to rehab them. The BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones joins us. Owen, you've been to the Saudi Rehab Center. Describe it for us.
Well, it's an interesting place. It's just outside of Riyadh. And it's, you know, pretty comfortable on the face of it. There's ping pong and swimming pools and, you know, nice compound for these people to live in. But the heart of the program is religious re-education. And basically, you're never going to persuade these people, who many have just come from Guantanamo, that America was right to invade Iraq, or that the American action in the drone attacks in Pakistan and things like that are justified. But you can persuade them that it is not for them to take an individual decision to resist America, that it is the decision of their governments and their religious leaders to declare a jihad or not. Many of the people I've spoken to, and I've spoken to former Guantanamo detainees now in Pakistan, in Saudi, in Yemen, and they all agree with this line that they say it was not for us to declare jihad personally. I think they're saying that if foreign troops came to their country, they may have a different view of it, but they shouldn't go abroad to volunteer to fight.
So you have seen some success, especially with these intense religious discussions with clerics who are brought in. But, the other part of the program that we're hearing about, former jihadists who are painting and drawing and art therapy classes, we understand they're even offered, as they move along in the process, potential wives, marriage possibilities. This has really caused a firestorm here in the U.S. People who have possibly been involved in violence now finger painting.
There is an art therapy course there. I found that surprising. Actually, the guy running it was very engaging, Saudi chap, and he was very interesting, and he claimed it works. I must say, as a cynical journalist, I wasn't sure it did. But to be fair to him, the American military are using exactly the same techniques in their detention centres in Iraq, and I've seen that too. And these marriages, the Saudis offer very substantial sums of money to these young men if they get married. And when I challenged the head of the program on this, he just said, look, it is the best control. If these guys get a wife, they calm down. And I then have come across it in Pakistan, and I know the Palestinians used it too way back. So it is something that has been used, and those who use it say it works.
We understand you met one of the young men who had survived a suicide bombing. Tell us about him.
This was a man who had bombed the Jordanian embassy in Baghdad. Claims he didn't know what he was doing. Frankly, I interviewed him for half an hour. I wasn't convinced about that. He drove a truckload of explosives towards the embassy, and I think had second thoughts and tried to run away. In fact, he caught a light as he was trying to detonate, or someone was trying to detonate this truck, and he has very severe burns. Now, he is in the Saudi program, and I'm saying to him, maybe you should be in jail, actually. But the Saudi idea is that these people can be reintegrated, that they are representative of, you know, a segment, a substantial segment of Saudi opinion, and that the best thing to do is to convince them that they made a mistake, to get their families to take responsibility for them, to give them a job, and to get them to calm down. And that is what the Saudis are trying to do. But undoubtedly, any democratic government would find it extremely difficult to put those kind of people through that kind of program. Right.
But one of the things you learned is something that the Saudis know, and it's behind their thinking, is how many of these jihadists just sort of, it was a sort of a spur of the moment, saw something on TV. It's not that deeply rooted a thinking, so the thinking is it can be pulled out.
Yeah, I think that is something which many people in the West don't really get, which is that the decision to go and fight is surprisingly casually taken in many cases. So, for example, I met a chap who had been at home watching telly, and he saw, you probably remember him, those pictures in Fallujah of a Marine shooting a wounded man.
Yeah.
And he just flipped. He just said, I'm going to go and fight. If you look at it from the point of view of an Al-Qaeda recruiter, it is actually quite easy to persuade these people to fight. Equally, it is quite easy to persuade them to stop.
Well, and what do the Saudis say to you about, by their own count, the 11 Saudis who were released from Guantanamo Bay, passed through the rehab program, and are now believed to have fled the country and joined terrorist groups, and are in fact maybe even leading terrorist groups in Yemen?
I was putting these points to Yemeni ministers, and they said, look, we will try and keep them under control, but we cannot guarantee that they won't go back to jihadism. And on the other hand, they've got many other jihadis in Yemen who, under America's 2001 rules, would definitely qualify for Guantanamo. I mean, I met, you know, a former bodyguard of Osama bin Laden. Now, if the Americans had got hold of him in 2001, I dare say he'd still be in Guantanamo. He's now in marketing. So you have to look at the whole context of this, and there is no way, short of holding these people until they die, of giving 100% guarantee that they won't reoffend.
That's the debate here in the U.S. Some are saying, so let's hold them until they die, you know, move them to a facility in the middle of the country and keep them there. Now you've introduced Yemen, which is also demanding its detainees and says that it will rehabilitate them. You've seen Saudi Arabia's center. Do you have faith that the Yemeni government will be able to even come close to the Saudi success?
Right. Well, the Yemenis had a program which was nothing like as thorough as the Saudi one. I mean, the Saudis have this fantastic benefit of massive oil revenues of hundreds of millions of dollars every day. So the money is just not a problem. And they've thrown money at it. The Yemeni program came down to a judge basically saying, are you sorry? And they said yes, and they got out. The perception in Yemen, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Saudi, is that most of these people are innocent. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not. On the other hand, they've not been charged. So it is very difficult to convince people that they are guilty. And you have to factor into this that that is a recruiting sergeant for Al-Qaeda. And that has to be part of the calculation.
It sounds like you're also saying that a recidivism rate of, let's say, roughly 11 out of 1,500 who've passed through the Saudi rehab program is one that's, you know, comparable to actually most recidivism rates, maybe even better than most recidivism rates, and one that may have to be accepted, even though what those 11 may go on to do may be far more.
It is a genuine dilemma, because if you let someone out who goes on to, I don't know, organize or even carry out, yeah, a major attack in which many, many civilians die, it is genuinely difficult, which is why 200 Guantanamo detainees, uncharged, are still there.
The BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, before we go today, how the global economic crisis is affecting American Olympic athletes. That's in 1 minute, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. The 2010 Winter Olympics begin in Vancouver, Canada, in just 5 weeks, and Stephen Colbert will be a part of them. Here's a clip from a recent Colbert report.
Nation, I don't have to remind you that we are sponsoring the U.S. speed skating team. And last week, I announced that I am going to the Vancouver Games. And folks, I'm not just going as some journalist. I am determined to be a member of the United States Olympic team.
Oh no, Stephen Colbert in spandex. Yes, and he is sponsoring the U.S. speed skating team. Because without Colbert's fans, U.S. speed skating would be, well, going around in circles looking for funding. It's just one example of how the global recession has impacted Olympic athletes. In a recent article, Boston Globe sports reporter Shira Springer called it the race for greenbacks before the race for gold. She joins us in the studio with more. Shira, always good to see you.
Likewise.
Well, as far as speed skating, Stephen Colbert told Time magazine, we must ensure that it is America's 38-inch thighs on the medal platform. And he's also got this running gag about wanting to make a team himself. Let's listen.
I tried out for the skeleton racing team, which is like bobsledding, only without teammates, steering, brakes, or sides. They call it skeleton because if you fall off, that's the only thing left when you cross the finish line.
But tell us how this all happened. How did Colbert Nation get involved with saving the U.S. speed skating team?
Well, in October, the U.S. speed skating team found out that its primary corporate cash sponsor, a Dutch bank named DSB, was going bankrupt, which left them with a $300,000 hole in their budget. So they basically campaigned and went out looking for a savior. And Stephen Colbert called up and said he would advertise basically for donations on his show, The Colbert Report.
And on his website, if you go right to the front page, there's a button where you can donate. And so how has Colbert done?
They've raised so far nearly $300,000. So they've made up that deficit U.S. speed skating was facing. And they're expected to exceed that. I mean, some figures that figured might be up to close to $500,000 by the time the Olympics.
And what do they get in return? Please tell me that he doesn't get to skate.
Well, he doesn't get to become a member of the team, but the Colbert Nation logo is on two spots on the skin suits of the U.S. speed skating team.
You have so many stories like this because it's not just DSB. Longtime sponsors, even though still operating, are pulling back on funding. Give us some examples.
Well, I think one of the examples that stood out in my research was Verizon, which has been a real long-term sponsor of the U.S. luge team and a real critical sponsor of their development program. Their cash commitment went from $1.2 million to $125,000.
Wow.
And that's a significant percentage of U.S. luge's budget.
Well, you also write about Bank of America, Home Depot. We're so used to the Home Depot ads talking about how they give these athletes a job so that they can train. What's happening there?
Well, Home Depot ended its partnership agreement with the USOC. And as a result, all these athletes who could work part-time jobs and essentially get paid for full-time and really have that time they needed to train didn't have the benefit of those jobs and were left out in the cold, basically, looking for jobs elsewhere.
So now you write about U.S. skiers, even gold medalists, going to fundraising events instead of training, and these unusual partnerships. We've heard about Stephen Colbert, but somehow curling made its way to football?
Yeah, apparently there's some tight bonds in the state of Wisconsin. U.S. curling and the Green Bay Packers teamed up, essentially. And at one Monday night football game in particular, in the tailgating zone at Lambeau Field, they held a curling demonstration. And it was very popular among tailgaters, go figure. And they put out a little can, and they collected donations for U.S. curling.
And possibly the first time many of those football fans even saw people going with a, you know, huge stone across the ice.
I'm going to guess it was the first time for many.
Another unusual pairing involves the biathlon. Now remind us, the biathlon.
Yeah, it's a combination of cross-country skiing and target shooting. And the whole difficulty is that you have to get your heart rate down after you ski these cross-country ski loops in time to shoot basically perfectly at five targets.
And someone had their heart stolen when they first saw it. And that's sometimes how this happens. It's just you have to have someone fall in love with the sport.
Yeah, the president of Stuart Film Screens, Grant Stuart, had his heart stolen, you're right, by U.S. biathlon. He was at the Lake Placid Olympics and saw biathlon for the first time and absolutely fell in love with it. And a couple of years ago, he decided he wanted to get involved in sponsoring it. And that's really what you get. A lot of these niche sports, you get a lot of these individuals who just have a passion for biathlon or for luge or for curling, and they want to be a part of the action. And those sports directors really would like to keep those people in the fold and encourage that kind of donation.
Well, we're not surprised that niche sports like biathlon or curling are struggling. But you write more popular sports like skiing, and gold medalists like Ted Ligety struggle as well?
Yeah, Ted Ligety, reigning Olympic gold medalist, didn't have a headgear sponsor. And
now, let's remind ourselves, that's the right on the front of the helmet. I mean, it's the most prominent spot. It's
exactly.
Usually a real, you know, really a real money ad, but it was blank for him.
It was blank, yeah. The sponsor that previously occupied that spot went bankrupt. And so he started the season without a sponsor. And interestingly, Putnam Investments stepped forward and said, you know what? We're usually with the arts and culture crowd. That's where we usually market our company. But why not try the sports crowd? And so now when Ted Ligety skis, he has this green neon helmet with the Putnam Investments logo prominently displayed.
Well, it's part of the problem that, you know, people just aren't paying attention yet. We never pay attention in between the Olympics.
Yeah, and that was a point that was made to me repeatedly, which is basically that Winter Olympic sports establish their brand every 4 years. And that's part of the problem. You know, people seem to think that these athletes automatically have the funding, and they don't. There's a lack of awareness about what it really takes to fund these winter sports, the expenses not only during Olympic years but between Olympic years.
Well, and I'm imagining, too, and you wrote about this, that it also shortens the reach of the Olympic program. You can't be out there looking for the next greats if you don't have the money to do it.
I think that's the real big concern at this point, which is the 2014 Olympics in Sochi. Where are the athletes going to come from?
Yeah.
There are development programs in place that have to be funded. You miss a couple of critical years in there, you're not going to have the top caliber athletes on the international stage come the next Olympics.
Yeah. We're speaking with Boston Globe reporter Shira Springer. And Shira, before we let you go, one last note, and it's a sad one. We know you've been following the story of Kevin Pierce, the 22-year-old snowboarder from Queechee Gorge, Vermont, who suffered a serious brain injury a week ago practicing, you know, the newest, most difficult move in snowboarding, the double cork. He's now slowly coming out of a coma, and everybody's keeping, you know, a good thought for him. We feel we haven't seen as much about this as we thought we might. And you say it might be because, you know, some parts of the country know about him, but maybe America didn't know that they were about to see a real stunning talent in a few weeks.
Yeah, this was really the American snowboarder on the cusp of something very, very big. Many people felt that he had the style and the athleticism to defeat Shaun White, the defending Olympic gold medalist. He had done it before. And people really felt that the Vancouver Olympics were going to be Kevin Pierce's time. People across the country who don't follow snowboarding closely might not understand how big a figure Kevin Pierce is in snowboarding and was going to be in the Olympics.
And we hope still is.
Yes.
Boston Globe reporter Shira Springer. To read her articles, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Shira, thanks so much.
Thank you.